The Pro Tools Expert Podcast with Russ Hughes, Julian Rogers, and Dan Cooper.
Well, good evening and welcome to Pro Tools Expert Podcast 308. It's the 26th of February 2018. I'm Russ Hughes.
I'm Julian Rogers.
And I'm Dan Cooper.
We've teamed up with eInstruments to offer an exclusive bundle that gives you two amazing Session Keys grand pianos for almost two for the price of one. Normally, each piano sells for €99 or $99, and there's no option to buy both the Session Keys Grand S and Y in a bundle. However, we've got this exclusive bundle for both the Session Keys Grand S and Y for just £99. But being the end of the month, this deal does close tomorrow, so hurry. You can also check out the deals from our partners in the Partner Deals section on the Deals page.
Good, let's move on to our talking points, and these are sponsored by our friends at Universal Audio. Over to you, Fab.
Good morning, children. This is Fab DuPont. The Pro Tools Expert Podcast talking points are brought to you with the support of Universal Audio.
If you're looking to get that big analog console sound from your in-the-box mix, well, if you buy and register any new UAD 2 DSP accelerator between January 1st and March 31st, 2018, you'll get the world's most authentic Neve API, SSL and UA console emulation plugins for Mac and Windows with a value of up to $1,196 absolutely free as part of the UAD Classic Console plugin promotion. Click the link in the podcast notes for more info.
Okay, so first talking point this evening, Avid survey ACA members with round two to help with product roadmaps, including Pro Tools and Sibelius. Quite a bit in this article. Julian, anything catch your eye?
Well, I mean, when I looked over it, the real standout thing is that there's no mention of taking folders in the Eclipse list any further, is there? I'm just checking the...
While you're looking for that, Julian, what was the whole round one and round two? It felt like the FA Cup draw. Does anybody know what that's about?
It was a fairly long survey. They take about 15 minutes to complete, and you have to do it in one sitting. It kind of feels quite formal, but Mike swears by it, and he's encouraging all of us to get involved with this because he thinks it's really going to help Avid with... the future of Pro Tools. So I haven't got around to doing this yet myself. I've had quite a lot of other things on my plate over the last few weeks. But there were some interesting things that popped up in the first round, like, and I did talk about this on a previous podcast, possible successor to the C24. I thought this sort of thing would be, the C24 would never going to happen again, but possibly it could. And there's several software things that have been mentioned as well. And Jules, you just touched on one there, didn't you? It was the
I've checked my facts now, just because.
But can I just go back? The round two is a reflection of what happened in round one, isn't it? It's not just it's been split into two parts because it's so big. It's that round one had questions, and if the things were popular, they made it into round two. Is that correct?
That is it. Yeah. Round one leads to round two, and the stuff that's discussed in round one is either accepted or rejected in round two. And the surprising bit is the bottom of the table.
Based upon what? Based upon popularity?
That I really couldn't say.
I don't know.
I mean, it can't be popularity just because folders in the clips list isn't in it, and that's been banging against the top of the idea scale for as long as I've been going anywhere near the idea scale.
And is it like the FA Cup in Eurovision? Do we get to a final winner? Do we get to round 16 or the semi-finals or the World Cup of Avid's product roadmap where we have a winner?
Yeah, Pro Tools Got Talent. The winner will be decided by Simon Cowell.
Is it like four people at Avid in chairs that swing round at some point? Yeah, we're going to go for that. I'm just intrigued by this round one and round two. As if it's just I find it a really odd way of doing product development.
It's got to be about engaging the user base and transparency and stuff. I can't think of any other way to do it in this way to declare halfway through.
Yeah, but we've had the ideas scale for so long, and it's kind of, I don't quite get it. I mean, I will participate in this when I've got some spare time, but what's the ideas scale for then? Do you know what I mean? That's a really cool thing. It helps Pro Tools 11, didn't it? I mean, they made a lot of noise when Pro Tools 11 came out and went, we've got the top 10 or the top 15, we've sorted them for you, and we're all happy. And now it sort of seems like they're ignoring that and going this route.
Well, the question is, we've got the Dirk, we've got a Facebook group that's full of stuff, we've got this, we've got
this community,
got Ideas Scale, we've got the others that have meetings with groups privately. I'm just, forgive me, but it does all feel a bit that, and somebody last week invited me to a Pro Tools group on Facebook that obviously the note didn't get to them, that I'm not on Facebook much anymore. And it was another one of, hey, if we really put some effort into this, we might get Abby to change some things. And I thought, well, I've been here for 10 years and I'm not sure personally. I'm not trying to be an old cynic, but I am being an old cynic that I'm not sure how much, I don't know, forgive me, how much it helps. But Mike, as you say, Mike swears by it, so just ignore me if you wish. Sorry, if you've got the time, cynical.
Yeah, if you've got the time, do it. If you haven't got the time like me, you're probably not going to end up doing it. But I'll try.
I'm looking down the list of things that have made it through round two. And I mean, some of them absolutely I'm going, yeah, great stuff. Let's have that, please. Marker track improvements, integrated pitch correction, things like that. Pro tier of network audio interfaces. I mean, interesting to see that they're looking so hard at hardware development when I thought that the consensus was that wasn't really what they did anymore. But there's some other stuff in here that, I mean, an iOS app for Pro Tools? I don't think they mean iOS controlling Pro Tools. No. I think they mean a standalone app for recording.
Sort of thing. Yeah.
I don't want that. I've never heard anybody say in front of me that they thought that was a good idea.
Somewhat ironic that sharing music online didn't make it. Avid not quite everywhere. Sorry, for those listening to the show, I haven't taken a cynic pill tonight. I will get positive during the show at some point. Perhaps I'll just shut up and let other people get excited about this stuff. But setting all of this aside, I have to say, 2018 and other stuff has been very positive, irrespective of how Avid got there. It does feel a little better. And talking to some of the team in the last year, some of those conversations have been a far more positive conversation than have been in previous years. So, I'm not writing Avid off. I'm just writing off possibly some of the ways that we think we can make a difference. Let's get a petition going.
Well, let's start a petition to see if a petition's a good idea.
Well, a petition to see if listening to us would be a positive thing. So from what I understand, coming back to this, sorry, I'm trying to be positive here. The ones at the bottom never made it to round two. So some did. And the last three in the list of I'm reading the page now. Sharing music online, game engine integration, and enhanced integration for Pro Tools and Sibelius have been kicked into the curb.
But if you go right the way down to the last, I think there's five tables in it. This is where we've got the Pro Tools stuff.
Okay, all right, okay. Control services, a Pro Tools, right.
But down here, I mean, take number management. Well, I mean, there's already kind of, I don't know, there's already a few ways of doing this. But
an enhanced cloud collaboration didn't make it.
But as we said earlier, Mike thinks this is a really good thing. So if you do have 15 minutes spare in your week, do check this out and get involved. But let's move across now to Talking Point 2. Russ, one of your articles, Modern recording technology fools us into thinking we are good at everything. Very good read this. I agree with everything you say.
Yeah, I just hanging around on my building site of a kitchen at the moment. And just as I say, I watch bricklayers doing stuff and watch plasterers and other people. And you think, oh, that looks dead easy. Do you know what I mean? And it just made me think about our industry where, because we're presented with but anything now, whether it be a great drum VI with amazing sounds or a bass guitar VI or mastering software, or if you're in the post side, I don't know, Foley in a box or whatever. There's virtually anything that can do anything now. It does make us kind of feel like we're gods in our own universe and we're invincible. But I think in reality, we're not. It seemed to be received well. Really, you guys are the guys to comment on this first. And I tell you what was really, really funny. I wrote the article on Saturday morning, and my wife then said to me, would I mind, could I get the washing machine going? Now, I've had plumbers doing first fix, so they've been using all these kind of push fix things all week. So I went onto the Screwfix site and found out there was a push fit option to add a washing machine connection. And I thought, well, how hard can it be? I've seen people doing this all the time. This was after I read the article, but I hadn't got a builder on site. So I went to Screwfix, bought it, and it literally is a push fit thing. So I turned the water off because that's a good start before I took the stop end that's on the pipe. So at the moment, we've got pipes all over the place that have things called stop ends on, which basically mean they're going to be attached to something at some point. But right now, in first fix, they're not. So I took the stop end off after watching a YouTube video of how to take a stop end off a pipe. But then found out that I had admitted to consider that there might still be water in the system, even though I'd turned off the stopcock. And so I'm now covered in about enough, well, the amount of water that's in the cold system without me first having the wisdom of a professional to drain it before I then carry on the part of this job. And then I also had to, because the roof's been changed on the house, I needed to replumb the waste on the sink. So eventually I got the washing machine going, but nothing like the builders did it in. And then I had to replumb the waste on the sink, which a bit watching my builder does in about 2 minutes. Took me 30 minutes to just replumb the waste on the sink. So I stand by everything I say because I then put it to practice and was a miserable failure. Well, not a failure. I managed to do it in the end, but not like a professional would. So, yeah, it was a take on that thinking. And I think... Dan, you had builders in recently. Just watching them, what they do, they have the tools and the experience and the wisdom. It's just, I don't know. Yeah. Julian?
Well, I'm thinking about in terms of kind of like production and audio and things, and I seem to have a lot of these kind of conversations that feel like a sort of mutual admiration fest or something where I have somebody saying, oh, wow, you're really good at something that I'm good at. And the whole time I'm thinking, but you're really good at something that I can't do. And that's, I find myself in these situations quite a lot just because I don't know about either of you, but I really value the things I know that I'm not very good at. And I think some mystical, amazing, talent that kind of, you know, is unachievable and unknowable great wisdom. And I totally undervalue the things that I know how to do because I think everything I know how to do is just obvious. And it's like, well, that's not hard. But I think everybody has that to some extent about everyone else's skills. Because of that, when I meet someone who doesn't think like that, it immediately puts me on alert of like, oh dear, just because I really like collaboration on projects. I really value what other people have got to say. And I wonder what the thought process is behind the people that I meet. And I've met quite a few who really want to keep people away from their project and insist on doing all of it themselves, whether or not it's the best idea or not. I know there are a few very, very well-known artists who've worked that way. And I mean, I've got one that I used to pick on, but I won't because I've drawn so much fire off people who enjoy this artist. But it's kind of like, of course you should work with other people because otherwise you'll end up with an album, but insert the artist of your choice in that because I'm not ready for that much flack saying something like that on the internet. But there's lots of them. Some of them do a fantastic job, but I always think, well, how much better would it have been if you'd just worked with people? Collaboration always produces the best work. I've worked with somebody before who would constructively exclude input from other people and remove what other people had done so that they could then put it under this umbrella of my work. And that's missing the point entirely of creating something, of whose work it is, particularly if there isn't, you know, some kind of spoils at the end of it in terms of kind of, you know, remuneration or something. It's just kind of like, make it as good as it can be because ultimately that's the point. And you can't do everything. You're quite right. Who'd want to?
Yeah, it's like, well, modern recording technology fooling us, thinking that we're good at everything. It's a bit like distortion on an electric guitar, and youngsters who are learning guitar for the first time and they think they sound good because they've got a load of distortion on the amp. And then you turn the distortion off and it's clean. You can hear they've got no technique, no finesse, very little musicianship. They're sort of making themselves believe they're good because the guitar sounds distorted and big. And it's, you know, it's very true. I've known many people over the years who just they buy so many plugins or they buy so many bits and bobs for their studio and they think they're getting better, but they're not. They're just spending money on something that's for making music. I don't really get that. Unless you work professionally and you work with clients regularly and you need certain tools for certain jobs, then that's fine. But like you guys know, I've been teaching my wife how to use Pro Tools over the last couple of months. She's recording more music than me in a week at the minute. She's prolific. But she hasn't got anything new for her setup. I just gave her some basic tools, an old Pro Tools 11 license, a Mac Mini, a couple of T-Rex plugins because they're really easy to use and sound great, Easy Drummer 2, and that's it. She gets on with it. She hasn't turned around and gone, oh, I need to get this Poltech style EQ, or I need to get this VI. She's getting on with it, which is great. And her skill is getting better and better and better every week because she's learning how to use those tools better. And actually learning how to use these tools like compression and EQ in new music. And I think that's where you get good at music production is by making lots and lots of music. It doesn't matter if it turns out crap or good. You're exposing yourself to lots of different styles of music, lots of different ways of making music, collaborating. Jules, you said there, she's collaborating with two or three people at any given moment. She's collaborated with Eli from Logic Pro Expert, our very own Rex. She's doing a song with him. And that is what's making her get good quickly. Or she could have gone the other route, got a studio set up and then bent my ear for a shitload of plugins and virtual instruments, and I don't think she would have got off the starting blocks.
Yeah, I don't have any issue with that. What I do though is that, like, people who, so if I've got to do a song and I've got to get it right, once I've got the drums figured out, then I send it over to James to play the drums what I would regard as properly, because I've used Superior Drummer or Easy Drummer to get those drums down. But I don't think it ever sounds right until a real drummer's put their drum part on it. And I'll get a real bass player to put it on because I can't play bass. I've got the, listen, there's not a VI that I don't own virtually on the market. And excuse the turn of phrase there. But I know there are certain things. So I know that bass players can do it better. If I want guitar parts, I get guitar players to do them for me rather than try and do them myself. Because there's nothing like somebody who has the experience and the ear and all that stuff to do it. I'm guessing you do loads of guitar parts for Georgie and play drums for Georgie and stuff like that. See, my problem isn't with people at home having a go at sort of getting tracks down. Probably aimed mostly at things like mastering software. Because as I said before, it's not about technology for me, that argument. It's about the objectivity and the experience of a decent mastering engineer who will listen to my track with a fresh set of ears. I've always thought that self-mastering is like trying to cut your own hair. You can do it, but I wouldn't advise it. I hope that point's clear. Jules, you must have seen this a lot when you were in education.
So much, so much. But, I mean, really my earlier comments about encouraging collaboration, I was thinking after I'd said that, that doesn't really apply to professionals where there's kind of, you know, it really does matter who's done what work. But in an educational setting, which actually is what I was thinking of when I was saying it, and people being protective and trying to take credit for something that essentially something I've said loads in the past is that having seen people agonize over quality and manage to put themselves under so much pressure by I blame online for this a lot. I mean, I would have loved to have had the resources in terms of information that people do now when I was learning about audio and music tech and that kind of stuff, because I was really starved of any information learning about this stuff pre-internet. But you can learn, you can come under so much pressure because I mean, like anything that's reasonably complicated, it's very front-loaded. You need to kind of know everything before you understand how simple it is. But a recording that's flawed that exists is infinitely better than a perfect recording that never got made. And yeah. If we all keep that in mind and just go, look, it just doesn't matter. What you do with it when it's finished, yeah, that's entirely different. And, you know, if it isn't good enough, fair enough, but you still got something from creating it. And we should all have a go, but we should be realistic about exactly who we are and how much experience we have and whether or not we should involve other people if we want to kind of, you know, make things as good as they can be.
Absolutely. Collaboration is king. Me and my wife run a songwriters community on Facebook called The Songwriting, and we put up some polls every so often. We ask people topical questions, such as one we did last week. Do you consider yourself the type of person that is a self music producer, or do you go to a professional, or do you work with your mates, or what's sort of the person that you think you are? And quite a few people are saying, no, I just go to a professional because I just want to write my music and then sing on it. That makes complete and utter sense, where there's loads of people out there that do self-produce their own music. And I know a few guys that do the whole band thing, and not very well. Not everyone is a James Ivey that can pick up any instrument and make it sound amazing. And that harms the song, because there could be a really good song in there, but because of your prides, you've kind of ruined the, or you've let the song down, the recording, because it's just not, it's not been given the love it might need.
So let's move on. Mike took a great bit of investigation and went and created an article, The History of Pro Tools, 1984 to 1993. Sounds like a mastermind.
If Mike went on Mastermind, if Mike went on Mastermind,
if you're not English, if you don't watch British TV, the BBC has a program called Mastermind where people answer questions for 2 minutes based upon their chosen subject, and this looks like that. But guys, I thought it was brilliant. Don't know what you thought.
I love it. Absolutely. We've got to, I mean, quickly, I think I know the answer with you, Russ, but first version of Pro Tools that you used, what was yours, Dan?
I started on 5. And that was when I was at Brit School College. And I bought in at 6 when it was on a 002. So that's 2003.
And I'm thinking that you were first in on 5 as well. Is that right, Russ? Or is that when you bought in? Were you using
I was in on a Digi 01. So I joined 1999.
So yeah, that's the same with me. I was
Was that 5?
That was 5. The very first version of Pro Tools I used was Pro Tools 4, but that was very brief use. And there was Pro Tools 3, of course, which I think was 98, possibly.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
But I'm trying to think if that was based on version 5 or on version 4. I mean, it was a funny thing. It was like 8 mono tracks and very little else.
But it was enough. Worked on Windows. If I remember right.
Yeah, I was using it on Windows.
Yeah, I think it was only Windows.
It was a fantastic idea. I mean, it was such a good idea. And I think it got misappropriated by some unscrupulous person who kind of like made a version that made it more capable than it was supposed to be, which I think kind of burnt DigiDesign a little bit. But it was still the most fantastic way in, just because Pro Tools was so unavailable to people prior to the 001. I mean, that was my first interface. And absolutely, I bought it because I was aware of Pro Tools, but it just wasn't available to me until that came out.
But a very interesting article, because I remember the Drumulator. So, and actually the big one for me is that I used to sell sound tools when I was working in sales in the industry. And I worked in, we had a studio supplies, specialist supplying company in Birmingham. And I remember sound tools because we used to have to buy, Mike only mentions the SE or Mac 2, but so we used to, you couldn't, unless you were an Apple store in those days, what was it called? It wasn't even a Mac reseller, I'll think of it in a bit. But basically there were only certain places you could buy Macs, and there were pretty stuffy places that architects and people used to buy a Mac from. You couldn't buy them generally, so we had to buy grey import Macs from a company called Camelot in Reading, and then put all the boards and stuff in. So we used to sell a Mac 2 CX, pretty heavily loaded. I think the Mac itself was about 11,000 quid with a monitor and stuff, and then the Sound Designer 2 software and hardware. I think it was about 18,000 quid for the stereo editing system on Sound Tools, but it was like magic for all of us. And that was in the days of basically you would mark up the regions give them names, and that's how editing, that's how the editing worked, and you could rearrange them in a kind of like list view. But the alternative at that point was audio file by AMS, which was 70 grand. So this was cutting edge and absolutely amazing. Lots of classical boys used to buy it off us for editing classical music. But it was a very, very popular system.
So this was a two-channel system. So in that case, what, crossfades and things were rendered?
Yeah.
I suppose?
Yeah, it was all pretty... Yeah, it was all pretty...
Wow.
Pretty low rent in those days. what you'd expect any computer to do now with a piece of software that's built in with it. But it was pretty... Yeah, but you... So you had a card that went inside the Mac. You had then this white box, which was your audio in and out, which did the A to D and the D to A. And it was, as I say, I think about 17,000 quid for a system. But it was the forerunner then for Pro Tools as they continued to develop it. So Pro Tools came, what, I think 2 years later with DeckEdit, which was the first kind of core technology for recording. This is way before Mix or anything like that, isn't it?
I'm just looking at this. I mean, the best bit for this for me is the screenshots of the software. What I'm getting is how similar it is to the current interface. It really, I mean, it hasn't changed fundamentally. It's the same, and so it should be, because, you know, I mean, any of us could sit at that system and operate it fine and know where everything was, and I'm sure we wouldn't find many things that would kind of catch us out. But something that I used to enjoy this in education is considering how desensitized generally digital native internet generation are. If you want to offend young people, show them old software. They get so offended at how ugly it is. It's really funny. But I guarantee if I showed these screenshots to a room full of kind of 17-year-olds, they would be literally agog. They would be horrified that software could ever look as grey and featureless as that. But apart from the just the graphics itself, it's all there. You know, everything there is that familiar Pro Tools edit window. So, I mean, that really is testament to some kind of good GUI design. If you think, Cubase got that arrange page together first, I think. But then Pro Tools taking it on and kind of like applying it to audio and an audio workflow. And it's the same. It is exactly the same thing.
I'll tell you what's weird is going back to an older version. Because I'm on Pro Tools 2018 down here in my studio, and my wife's on Pro Tools 11. So when I go and help her with one of her songs, I'm like, brilliant, okay, I'm just going to commit this track. Oh, no, I can't. and other little features. You're like, why is it lagging? Why is this lagging? Oh, hasn't got this catched because it's not HD. It'd just be interesting to actually find like a Pro Tools 6 studio and just spend half hour working on that, just to really appreciate where we've come with Pro Tools, what it is now. I remember getting Pro Tools 6, you know, well, I've got the 002, I think it cost me a couple of grand. And I do remember thinking how kind of featureless it was compared to something like Logic Pro that had a million plugins and a load of VIs. And Pro Tools 6 was kind of just really... audio editing, mixing, but it didn't really come with much. Not until later versions of Pro Tools come out, and you got the Ignition pack and the Air plugins and other bits and bobs.
Do you remember the first time you saw it? I do. Because I was out of the industry for a bit, and I was then writing. I was a writer, and I'd recorded a load of stuff on, I think, ADATs. And I went to mix it at a Pro Tools studio, which was local. When I say local, about half an hour's drive from my house. And I remember spinning it all into Pro Tools, and then sitting in front of Pro Tools. And then the first time I saw him edit a piece of audio on the timeline, it just blew my mind. And then first time I saw him use, I think, Sans Amp on a guitar, and it was like, because I'd never seen plugins used, it was just absolutely amazing.
This it reminds me, the first time I used it, it was this, and this story kind of gives a bit of perspective on just how far we've come. I found an old tour folder. I was having to clear out today, and I found an old tour folder that I'd hung on to from donkeys years ago, 1990 something or other. And it had got all the technical riders and directions and all that kind of stuff, that, and printed out maps for a tour to show me how to get to all the venues, all put together by the tour manager. It's amazing. You just think in these kind of days of Google Maps and SatNav and stuff, but in those days you're looking at printed out maps while you're driving to the venue. But on this particular show, there was I was given a DAT recording of this piece of music that had been recorded in some space in East London. I don't know exactly. But anyway, this was the only copy of this recording. And the whole tour was kind of pretty reliant, well, the second half of the show was entirely reliant on playing this DAT back, and it was being played live back off DAT every night. I had it, and I thought, oh, I need to back that up quick, you know, get a copy. So I was going to go to a friend's studio who'd got two DAT machines, and I was going to make a copy. Before I did that, I remember I got in after the first show. Well, it wasn't the first show, it was a tech rehearsal, but getting in and just chucking my bag down in the corner in my messy house that I had in my youth, with all sorts of stuff lying around. And I must have been just watching telly and having a cup of tea, and I just happened to look at this bag that had this DAT in it, and I thought, what's that on top of? And it was on top of an upended 15-inch bass driver. And I just remember looking at it thinking, oh, magnetic tape, that's not good. And it was fine. It was fine. It was it hadn't degaussed itself. But the very next opportunity I got, I copied it, and it was at a theatre in Oxford, and they had a Pro Tools 4 system, which I had no idea how to use, but it was a way of transferring in the absence of a second DAT machine. I could just dump it onto there and put it back on and do one little edit I wanted to do. And I remember recording this thing in off the DAT, make the cut, looking around for some scissors tools, because I expected to find something like that, because I had seen Cubase before. Unfortunately, it was Pro Tools, and nobody seemed to know how to work it. But seeing the waveforms, and this is kind of like where I was going with this, was absolute. It was a revolution to me, because I knew this piece of music very well by this stage, and seeing it graphically represented was entirely new, uncharted waters to me. And that must have been, taking a guess here, 97 possibly. So, you know, that's 20 years ago. And yeah, it's the most familiar thing in the world. You just assume that you can do that. And if you need to edit something, you just do it visually. I mean, the amount of edits that we make without listening to them, you know, I mean, hopefully we check them. I certainly do, but I'm very often I'm not actually having to change anything, because you can just do it, chop, 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 chop. That's going to be fine. Listen back and it is. The idea of having to listen to stuff in real time is extraordinary.
Oh, yes. I mean, I remember the first time I sat down at Pro Tools was quite a large moment of joy and relief, because I was learning the first few lessons of my sound engineering course, music technology course at the Brit School, in their analog room on a massive Soundcraft desk, tape machines, racks full of gear. And I really struggled for like 3 or 4 weeks worth of these lessons, because I couldn't see all the knobs and all the dials. It was really, really difficult. And I was worried, and I was staying later after lessons, like drawing pictures of the channels and all these sort of things, because then I could look at my notes in front of me in a lesson without having to look like an idiot and lean up and put my nose on the desk to see what these pots did. And then we learned our fundamentals of sound in there, and then we went through to the digital studio, that being Pro Tools with the Control 24, and I sat down and went, yes, I can see this. I thought, thank God. You know, I was really worried. I thought I might make the wrong choice doing the course, because I thought, if I need my eyes to see all these really tiny things, I'm going to struggle. And luckily, Pro Tools was really clear to see. The Control 24 ergonomically was really easy to use with the software. Yeah, and I just got on with it. After that, the rest is history. So, yeah, I think it was a different era. Or a few decades before, I think I would have struggled if it wasn't for things like a DAW.
But when did you first see it, Dan? Was it at college?
That was at college. That would have been 2002, and that was Pro Tools 5. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was people's... My first one was the Digio 1. I loved it. It was just brilliant. I remember getting it and thinking it was the most magical thing I'd ever had. Once I'd seen it, basically I went to that studio, saw it in action, and thought, what do I need to do? What do I need to sell, including children, to get myself a Pro Tools system? And I went out and bought a Digio 1. I'd originally had ADATs, and just this was like a world apart. And so that was mine. What was your first one, Julian?
001. As soon as it came out, I got one. And I remember I went and collected it in person from Digital Village in Birmingham. And I remember carrying it back up the road and, you know, back to New Street and stuff. And yeah, no, same story. Absolutely blew me away. It was just the best thing I'd ever had. I didn't really worry about things like the numbers of preamps and stuff in the very early days. That quickly became an issue. But not very long after that, I got an ADAT expansion and stuff. But the thing that always kind of I thought was really great, but I thought it was a real shame that it was like it was. Do you remember it had that monitor button where you could just connect up kind of like a playback system and you could play through it without the system powered up? And I love that, the fact that you could just leave it rigged, and if you're just like playing some music, you're just like, you know, straight through on that. But it was so quiet. it was ridiculously quiet. The only Avid interface I've ever had that didn't get a crackly volume pot as well.
The W2s are awful for that.
Yeah, I've got a 003 and a bit behind me that's suffered the same fate.
What was the first one you owned, Dan?
Well, I had to get Pro Tools when I was finishing up at the Brit School. So 2 years of using their studio come to an end, and I was going to university, and the university I chose to go to didn't have any Pro Tools stuff. They only used Logic. And I thought, I've already tried Logic. It's cool, but I'm a Pro Tools boy now. I've got to get a Pro Tools rig. So I spent my first load of student loan on a 002, and I got a B-stock one, so one that was on the shop floor for a few months, got it a bit cheaper, got a used G4 Mirador Mac from a friend of a friend's, fairly cheap, and just got on with that for several years, and I absolutely loved it. You know, the 002 being its like a little baby brother to the Control 24, it was perfect. So I had control surface, 8 ins, 8 outs, something like that, and Pro Tools, and I just got on with it. I wore that thing out. I used it so much, and it's a real shame that there's not really products like the 002 out now. There are, but not quite like the 002 factory.
The thing that really kind of puts it in perspective for me is thinking, I'm sure you'd have been the same boat on this one, Russ. When I bought my 001, Pro Tools shipped without a reverb, and they had some kind of change of heart or something, because I remember I got kind of like as an extra thing taped onto the side of the box a disc authorization for D-verb.
Yeah, I don't remember that. I remember in the early days of getting Pro Tools when you got the plugins, because I think I got the ignition pack with mine or something. There was a name for it.
Ignition pack.
I recall that I had to use these cards. Do you remember the authorization in those days?
Yeah.
Cubs, cards, hips, dogs, monks. Do you remember that? You had to put all those ridiculous challenge and response things in.
Yeah.
I remember authorizing those for labs at a college.
You must have spent a day doing it.
More than one.
Yeah, I was going to say. What I was going to say, though, because we haven't got to that in the dateline yet, is I do believe that Digio 1 was the most significant Pro Tools release ever in terms of Avid, because that was the moment when it democratized Pro Tools. Up until then, only studios and people with lots of money could own a Pro Tools system, because it was thousands. And suddenly, for $1,000 or about, everybody could own Pro Tools. And I think that was, for me, if I was going to vote one product that is the most significant Pro Tools product ever, it's the Digio 1 in my book.
I've got somewhere, in fact, I even know where, I can picture where they are in the house, a couple of, there were VHS videos that I sent away to get. One was about Pro Tools, and it was kind of like a studio and kind of like some very 90s looking people in a studio full of beige computers tracking a band. And then there was one introducing the 001. And it was the people who work for DigiDesign, who I don't know their names, wearing Hawaiian shirts and shouting and leering at the camera and recording a quite psychedelic track. And I mean, I'll have to look on, see if they're on YouTube anywhere, because, yeah, absolutely fantastic. But if anything shows the culture change, these two things came out pretty much the same time, immediately before I bought my 001. And you've got this, you know, this is a professional tool. I've got an operator sat here doing everything for me. And the whole thrust of the thing seemed to be about there was no rewind time. They kept saying this. It was like a new thing, because obviously you think about what these systems were being sold to replace. It was like a big selling point at the time. And of course, it's irrelevant now. But and then suddenly there's this homebrew, we're at someone's house, we're recording in their kitchen kind of thing. And that's exactly what you're saying, isn't it? Pro Tools moving from a pro environment into you know, a home recording market. And yeah.
But what's really interesting, if you speak to anybody that uses analog tape these days, I remember doing this. I asked a lot of my producer friends who work on tape machines, what's the one thing you love about tape? And they said the rewind time. It gives us time to think. It gives us time to gather our thoughts and breathe. And they miss that. Isn't that interesting? That the thing that they claimed was the big winning point was the actual thing that was the thing that lots of kind of top engineers were saying no.
But don't think for too long, or you get that flack, 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 and you've got to put the tape back on again.
I always think they should have put a rewind time option in, so you could tick a box and it would work out how long it takes for the average tape to rewind.
No. Be fair, Pro Tools has got that feature. It's a crash, but you kind of got to reboot. It's a reboot time. Relaunch Pro Tools. That gives you something to think about that time. Right, so let's move across now to community feedbacks, and this is sponsored by our friends at RSPE Audio.
The Pro Tools Expert Community Feedback is brought to you with the kind support of RSPE Audio Solutions. Great people and great prices.
There is finally an affordable way to get yourself some PMC studio monitors. PMC's new Result 6 is the result of 26 years of painstaking development, bringing you PMC's patented technology and sound at an affordable price. Contact RSPE Audio or visit the RSPE website using the link in the podcast notes to learn more about the Result 6. And we actually haven't got any community feedback this week, so we'll just roll on to questions from the community.
Peter McComas, I think I've got that right, forgive me Peter if I didn't. A question about Pro Tools HD native Thunderbolt interface monitoring. His session info is he's got Pro Tools 10 HD native, HD native Thunderbolt interface, HD MADI sync HD, sample rates 48K, bit depth 24-bit, frame rate 2997, number of tracks 64. His inputs are cascaded via the MADI, and outputs are cascaded as well by the MADI. I can't figure out a way to properly PFL tracks via the headphone jack of the HD native Thunderbolt interface. According to the manual, the headphone output is always going to mirror outputs 1 and 2 of the chosen interface, in this case, HD MADI interface. That's annoying, but fine. In the output tab of the I/O setup, I select outputs 1 and 2 as my AFL PFL path. Then under options solo mode, I choose PFL and get the ability to solo any track to my heart's content. However, PFL doesn't mute the outputs of the tracks 1 and 2. My current understanding is that's because it's mirroring outputs 1 and 2. Then the PFL will only add to the output of the first two tracks. What I'd really like to do is change the outputs of the headphone jack listens to, but I don't think there's an option. I'd settle for any solution that has had PFLs behave like SIPs down the PFL path specified in the I/O setup. Please let me know if I can clarify anything. Julian, any thoughts on this?
This is one of those annoying things where I want to go and open that bit of Pro Tools, but Pro Tools is kind of busy at the moment. So, okay, you want to set a separate output. I have no experience of the HD native Thunderbolt box, but if you say that it mirrors the headphones aren't individually assignable, then that's how it behaves. That being hardwired has got to be down to the low latency monitoring path, I would have thought. Mm. But the thing that confuses me about this is why you want PFL behavior rather than solo. just it's not something I've ever wanted. I mean, I totally get it if you're game staging analog equipment, but then when you're PFLing, it's about the meter more than it is the sound that you're getting. But are you saying that you don't want a solo, you want a PFL, or is it about the path that it's going down? I mean, in a purely native system, for example, you've got the audition path, which you can set to be different from your main monitoring path. And if what you're saying is you can't do that or something like that with your solo path, then you are a bit stuck. This has to be down to low latency. Can you do it via alternative output? I mean, if you don't need that low latency, doesn't actually say what you're... I mean, I'm guessing from this that you're mixing, you're not tracking, in which case that latency performance is going to be less of an issue. And you can presumably set up some headphone send via a suitable headphone amplifier via any available output. So perhaps that's a way around it if there's this hardwired thing, which I'm not aware of, but specific to that hardware. Anyone else?
No, no ideas from me, unfortunately.
No, I'm lost on it as well. I think he's on the right path, and it's this hardwiring lark. But the hardwiring's happening because of what you say, the low latency monitoring, isn't it, Julian?
I would imagine so. I mean, the Pro Tools XD
Native has to have some kind of low latency path somewhere, doesn't it?
It's only got one, as opposed to an HDX system which has multiple low latency paths. But if that's not important to what you're doing, then I'm thinking with a kind of a little bit of lateral thinking, maybe you could just set up an alternative output and forgo that built-in headphone output, which is kind of frustrating because you've got one there ready to go. You just can't use it for what you want.
The Pro Tools Expert podcast is created using Source Connect Now from Source Elements. Register now for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
If you've ever tried to do interviews over the internet with apps like Skype, you'll know how hit and miss the audio quality and connection can be, and even on a good day, it isn't really good enough for a long-form interview. We now use Source Connect Now, which offers ISDN-equivalent quality audio using a Chrome browser, no software to install. To get your free account, follow the link in the podcast notes. So, find of the week. Dan!
You may have noticed that the tone of my voice might be a little bit different to the norm. That's because I've got a new microphone. I've got the SEX1R ribbon microphone. I bought my wife the SEX1 condenser microphone for Christmas, and I absolutely love that mic. It is so good for next to nothing. It's about £120, thereabouts. And I've been toying with the idea of getting a ribbon microphone. I just didn't want to spend the big money that some, you know, ribbon microphones demand. So I thought I'd buy, let's call it the brother of the other microphone, and give it a go, see if I like it. So far, so good. And I'll do a video of this with the other condenser microphone that my wife has got, and sort of like hear the differences between them and find some good applications for them. And go from there. So that's my find of the week.
I've got a good application, Dan. Something that I've done in the past is used a ribbon and a condenser through a lack of choice of microphones, I should add, in an MS array, and then with some judicious EQ on the ribbon, you can get an acceptable stereo image. Because MS is inherently so symmetrical, it's not the best way to do it, but it's a way that works, because unlike in a normal coincident array, it's not going to be lopsided because of the difference in frequency response. Try that and see what kind of EQ curve you need to get something that works. Not necessarily the same, but that'd be a nice little idea for a video.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, Russ, you've got a ribbon, haven't you? You got an SE ribbon?
Yeah, I think they're great. I think they're really, really good.
I think you've got the same one as me. Have you got one of the Voodoo ones?
I've got the Voodoo one on acoustic guitar. It's beautiful.
Is it the active stunning. Or the passive? Is it the short or the long?
It's the short one.
I've got the long one.
So on acoustic guitar, it's just so balanced. I did some. If you go and search our site using the search engine on the site, you'll find me. I put some audio examples of me just recording an acoustic, and it just sounded beautiful. Really balanced, really
microphone
warm
placements, wasn't it? No, that was a different one.
This was about me just doing some examples of this, and it. Well, I did put it in different places, but this was just how beautiful it sounded. I was really stunned by it and really pleased. They're not as easy to work with ribbon mics, obviously, because you've got to get the gain up, and there is a bit of audio education where you just have to understand gain staging a bit. So you have to drive, because they're basically dynamic microphones in essence, aren't they, Julian? But you do have to give it a bit of gain, and obviously down the cool idea is to use like the FET heads and stuff like that on them, and the cloud lifters, things like that. So
that's exactly why I bought the active version, because it preceded me buying a decent mic preamp. So I knew I'd have trouble if I bought the passive one with the preamps I was going to be driving it with. So,
Russ, what's your find of the week?
My find of the week, and blushes aside, is that watching Julian's video on Audio Suite, the tip that he came up with, that it's one of those moments, and I think one of the people commented. So I've been using Pro Tools since nearly 20 years, and I never knew that there was this little drop down where I could either process one piece of audio or all the clips that are designated to that audio. So for example, if you had a load of kick drums across a timeline made up of one clip, you could either do one of them or all of them. It's quite clever. And as I say, it's funny how we think that we know everything about a piece of software, and somebody comes along and says, oh, did you know it does this? All power to your elbow, Julian. Great idea.
Thank you very much.
Nice little tip.
I like all the dull, dusty corners of Pro Tools, and Audio Suite's something that I think some people write off, and they shouldn't, because it's so powerful. And there was a nice comment on that story of someone saying, couldn't you just use commit? And I said, not for reverse, you couldn't, because it's always been my favorite example when people don't see the relevance of rendered stuff, who kind of show me a real-time reverse plugin.
Yeah, Julian, what's your find of the week?
It's a video that actually it was inspired by. There was a Facebook post that I saw about loudness and dynamic range or loudness range, and it had some. I didn't recognize the name of the person whose post it was. I looked them up and then found out they were a former president of the AES. So I went, oh, okay, you probably know what you're talking about then. But Bob Katz had chipped in with a couple of really, really exhaustive and very wise answers to some stuff. And I thought linking to Facebook posts isn't really that something I want to do in the podcast notes. So I thought, well, actually, quite a few years ago, I watched a series of videos on YouTube from Thomas Lund, who at the time was with TC. He's now with Genelec. And he's just one of these extremely clever, knowledgeable guys to whom we should all listen, because he really knows his stuff. And he did a series of videos on loudness. And it was through watching that stuff that I first understood R128 and all this loudness stuff that Mike enjoys so much. And if you haven't seen these videos, do, because he's just the person that you want to explain this stuff to you. So, yeah, I can't recommend those enough.
Good. And on that recommendation, it's good night from me.
It's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
Good night.